all together now. This is Eleanor LeCain. The results of the 2020 election are in, and the people have elected Joe Biden president and Kamala Harris vice president. They won with over 77 million votes, the highest vote turnout ever. People overcame voter suppression efforts and a raging pandemic to vote in a new Democratic president and the first Black, first Indian, first woman on a winning ticket to the White House. For four long years, we marched for justice, starting with the Women's March the day after Trump's inauguration. We marched for racial justice with the Black Lives Matter movement. We marched for workers' rights with unions and allies. We marched for climate action. And finally, decisively, we marched to the polls and elected a new president and vice president. The long national nightmare is ending, and a new day is dawning. This victory is the result of a lot of work by a lot of people. It involved turning some states that usually vote Republican to this time voting Democrat, including Georgia in the South and Arizona in the West. Our first guest, Senator Nan Orrick of Georgia, will help us understand how she and others turned Georgia from red to blue and what we might expect of the two U.S. Senate runoff races in January that will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Following her will be a conversation with Karina Iribe with the Movement Voter Project, who organized in the state of Arizona and helped Arizona move from red to blue. So first up is my good friend, Senator Nan Orrick of Georgia. Nan has served 10 terms in the Georgia House of Representatives, where she was Georgia's first female House Majority Whip. She's been serving in the Senate there since 2007. She's a founder of both the Georgia Legislative Women's Caucus and the Working Families Agenda Caucus. She was the longtime president of the Women Legislators Lobby, a network of women state legislators, which I helped to launch in 1991. A veteran of the civil rights and the women's movements, Nan was recognized by Time magazine for her participation in the 1963 March on Washington. Senator Nan Orrick, welcome back to All Together Now.
Great to see you and great to be with you and your audience, Eleanor.
Yeah, well, such a happy occasion. It's so nice.
Indeed.
Do you feel like this dark cloud over America is finally lifting?
I almost feel like there are bound to be some Republicans that are secretly glad that we're ousting this clown from the White House with our votes. In the long run, they'll appreciate us even more.
Right, absolutely.
In Georgia right now, of course, Eleanor, we are in the throes of the battle.
Right.
Big runoff elections that will determine the makeup of the U.S. Senate. Unbelievably, it all comes down to the votes in Georgia in this runoff between these two Senate seats that are in an unusual situation up for on the same ballot, because our former U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson, a Republican, retired as his term approached its end, so that the Republican governor could appoint a Republican replacement and get her positioned. That's mm-hmm. Kelly Loeffler, get her positioned to get elected on the ballot. She's unelected. She's not elected. She's an appointed person. And she's got Raphael Warnock, Reverend Warnock, here in Atlanta, running to hopefully defeat her and take that U.S. Senate seat. And then we have, I'm just reminding viewers, most people that know this that are following politics at all, the second race that we have is the race of John Ossoff to make David Perdue a one-term U.S. Senator. He has served one six-year term, and he's now up for re-election. And John Ossoff, who helped light the spark that has started Prairie Fire here in Georgia, when he ran for a seat up in the northern suburbs for Congress and came within a hair of beating the incumbent there. And that was 2016, actually, in a special election. So that's how those races are lined up, and it's two Senate seats, and it's what's required to give the margin to the Democrats in the U.S. Senate.
Right. You know, Georgia's become the new center of the political universe for the United States right now. And even in the presidential race, it's not officially over, I don't think. I was checking with the Associated Press just before the show, and I think we have Biden with about a 14,000 vote lead, and it's definitely leaning Democrat. And what's your sense? Will it officially go to Biden? Will Georgia vote for Biden in this election?
Well, those votes have been counted, and Georgia was announced as a Biden state, with Biden getting the majority as the vote counted and the votes rolled in. Now, what's happened is, as you said, it's become this epic struggle in Georgia for these two Senate seats.
Right.
And these two senators that are holding the seats now, Kelly Loeffler, David Perdue, in a scandalous move, issued a joint letter calling on the GOP elected Secretary of State to resign.
Really?
Charging that he had not run an honest election here in Georgia. And that is really preposterous. I'll just say to you that the head of our state ACLU is the daughter of Andrea Young, mm-hmm. an attorney, a brilliant woman who is revitalized the ACLU chapter here in the state and is doing great work. And she has worked alongside the Secretary of State and says that she has no doubt that he ran an honest election here. We elected Biden, and mm-hmm. we have runoffs for these two Senate seats. And so he is now, just to add to the drama, our Secretary of State, Raffensperger, just announced yesterday that he's going to have a hand recount of all the ballots cast in Georgia. All right, an enormous, prodigious task, and one that's very, very costly. And he did that under the intense pressure of mm-hmm. the Trump supporters. He's now, it's just as announced today, he's in quarantine. His wife has tested positive. And so now the Secretary of State is quarantining, and Georgia is in a deep red pandemic mode. It was some of the highest cases in the country. So there's a lot to digest here. We are keeping our eyes on the ball and getting across the goal line on the January 5th runoff. He also just announced that runoffs that were going to be held for contested state and local races, like for DAs and state Senate and House seats, all of those have been moved to the January 5th. He did an emergency order to move all of those to January 5th. And so you're going to have this incredible race to the finish line. And as you said, just to underscore, it's made Georgia the epicenter of the political universe of the United States right now. And great discord within the Republican Party here, because elected Republican officials are being accused by the Republican candidates for the Senate runoff of not running an honest election. So you have people in the Republican Party, Republican leaders, picking sides in that battle. Are they going to go with the Trump, the preposterous Trump lie that the election, that he won Georgia, or are they going to stick up for their duly elected GOP leaders here who ran the election?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I want to get more into that in a minute, but let's first explain, let's celebrate this incredible victory that here right. We have this reliable Republican state of Georgia is now suddenly voting Democrat for Biden and Harris. So you are just like the absolute, Georgia politics inside and out. That you must be like a cat rolling in catnip here with with this success. Well, how do you explain the victory?
Well, let me say, it's remarkable that you and I have been talking for 10 or so minutes now, and we have not yet lifted up the name of Stacey Abrams.
Yes.
Let me do that now. Let me hasten to do that. Stacey Abrams was elected as a young, smart, savvy lawyer in, I believe it was 2006. By 2011, she rose to become the House Minority Leader, the leader of the Democratic Caucus. And I credit her with the tremendous progress that we have made, because she brought a vision, and she brought the ability to inspire people and to create an infrastructure and raise the money to fund it here in Georgia, when the old Democrats that had lost power and were in the minority were being naysayers to her and saying that her plan would never succeed. Well, her plan has succeeded mightily. She ran for governor in 2018 and was it was a 50,000 vote margin. And our attorney general at the time, our secretary of state at that time, was running for governor, but he was also serving as secretary of state in charge of the election, which is preposterous on its face. Mm-hmm. He had purged and had been in and out of court countless times about his efforts to purge voters from the rolls here in Georgia. And let me just tell your listeners, I don't expect that they would know this. This is almost ancient history. Georgia was the first state in the country, Eleanor, to put in voter ID requirements in 2005.
Very restrictive.
Very restrictive. The first, it first was passed here in this state. Black Democrats, white Democrats together staged a walkout in protest of it. But it was this a rigid voter ID law that was put in here under the false banner that there's voter fraud. And anyone that knows anything about the data and the studies, voter fraud is not a massive issue across the country, but yet it was a solution to a problem that didn't exist. But that started here in Georgia, so it somehow brings us in one of history's fascinating twists, that the first state that put in voter ID to suppress the Democratic vote, to suppress the Black vote, that is that's now we see. In the throes of this struggle to turn blue. And we have been for years saying that we were on this trajectory. Stacey Abrams' leadership brought us here. She created the first big, massive voter registration effort, Eleanor, that I think launched in 2013, 7 or 8 years ago, the New Georgia Project. Mm-hmm. And they have run consistently massive voter registration across the state, because what Stacey Abrams lifted up is that there's a vote out there. There's a sleeping giant in places like Georgia, and that is the underserved and undersolicited Black vote. We saw it turn out for Barack Obama in his 2008 race when lines wrapped blocks around the polling places and the huge African-American population here in Georgia. We're 33% African-American. And that vote was activated by the President Obama's race and has been targeted and lifted up and reached out to and engaged by Stacey Abrams' efforts in the years since then. And we also have a growing population of other minority voters, Asian Pacific Islanders, Latinas, Latinx, and those ranks continue to grow. And we're turning our suburbs blue. They used to be white flight counties. Two of the biggest white flight counties in Georgia, Gwinnett and Cobb, both became Democratic in this election. So a new wind is blowing, and an infrastructure has been put in place for massive civic engagement, bringing more and more people into the political process and into both the nonpartisan voter registration drives and also GOTV drives to make it easier for people to follow all of this. Everybody's not like us, Eleanor, and we know that. Everybody does not read the headlines every morning and dig deep into all of the online political commentary. you know, some people say we're not normal, but thank God we don't let that dissuade us from
good. That's right. Work.
But vast sweeps of our populations in this state and any other one are busy keeping their head above water, raising their children, maintaining a household income to meet the needs and you know, coping with all the vicissitudes of modern life. And then the job is waking them up, getting them good information, providing pathways to be civically involved, to return to the voting booth, in this case, in a runoff election that is going to determine whether Mitch McConnell is put into the minority up there in the Senate. We all got to remember Mitch McConnell was not elected the next president. Joe Biden was elected the next president. And so winning these Senate seats in Georgia would give us a Senate that's going to work with Biden on healthcare issues, on education issues, on addressing the poverty and the income gap, on investing in infrastructure, you know, which means schools, bridges, roads, and very important infrastructure need that we have is for a universal child care,
mm-hmm.
early childhood development.
Well, especially now, so many women are having to leave their jobs because the kids are out of school and they have to stay home and take care of them. So we've got to get that child care.
Exactly. And so that's part of the crucial infrastructure. And having Kamala Harris as our next vice president, and who would be she would be the president of the Senate, too. She would chair the Senate proceedings and have the tiebreaker vote. So this election down here in Georgia, the Democrats prevail, we put Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff in the U.S. Senate, then we have a Senate that's 50-50, and with Kamala Harris being the tiebreaker.
Absolutely. Well, first off, I join you in saluting Stacey Abrams. She just did such a phenomenal job. Yeah. And not only has she helped to turn Georgia Democratic, but she's laid out a template for how other southern states and western states, how to up the vote count for the Democrats. So
true. So true.
I'm just so grateful to Stacey Abrams for all of that. And I just want to, like you said, you know, you and I are kind of very intense, focused on politics, and most people aren't. But just so our listeners understand what's at stake, it's not just two Senate seats for the U.S. Senate that are up for grabs right now in Georgia, because the races were so close. Now they have a runoff in January. But if the Democrats win both of those seats, then the Democrats have 50 votes and the Republicans have 50 votes. But as you mentioned, Vice President Harris will be the leader of the Senate and have the 51st vote. So that would give the Democrats majority in the Senate. And when you have majority control, you set the agenda. You say what's voted on, when it's voted on.
That's right.
It's not voted on. I mean, you really run the show. So those two votes are absolutely critical. We all have high hopes for the Biden-Harris administration. You mentioned many of the issues we care about with the child care and healthcare.
The
pandemic, education, climate action, so much action we want to take. And if Biden cannot get legislation through the Senate, he's going to be very restricted in what he can do. He can still do things through executive order and through administrative offices, but Democrats have the House, we have the White House, we do not have the Senate. If we get those two votes from Georgia in this runoff, we will have the Senate and be able to pass through all the legislation we need to help the country.
That's right. You have made it plain and simple and easy to understand. That is absolutely, you have stated the case. The winners, if we can put the Democratic candidates in the winning positions in these runoff election in January 5th, we have control of the U.S. Senate.
Right. And knowing how absolutely critical those two seats are to everything we care about in the country, including our democracy itself and legislation to deal with money and politics and everything else, the House has already passed fantastic legislation.
Exactly.
Called that H.R. 1 bill that would, it's like the most major democratic reform for the voice of the people in the history of the country. It's already passed with Nancy Pelosi, Speaker, throughout the House. We have to get it passed in the Senate, which has been blocked by Mitch McConnell.
That's right.
The Republicans controlling the Senate. If we get those two votes there in Georgia, we can pass that major democratic reform and everything else that we need to do. What can our listeners do to help? Like, should we all be moving to Georgia to organize, or would that be a problem?
Fair Fight Action. Fair Fight is the overarching organization that Stacey Abrams launched in 2018. And it's actually worked, I believe, in 18 states across the country to bring more resources to the battles in the Democratic elections. So that is a... America Votes Georgia, the America Votes chapter that is Georgia, is working closely with Fair Fight. Those are two groups to be in touch with. And as well, the Raphael Warnock campaign and the John Ossoff campaign. That's John, J-O-N, Ossoff, O-S-S-O-F-F. And Raphael Warnock, W-A-R-N-O-C-K. Those two campaigns, along with Fair Fight, will provide pathways for you to help make a difference. I have friends that are coming here to work. They'll mm-hmm. be assigned in essential places by Fair Fight. And I have many friends out of this national network of working with the women legislators mm-hmm. Across the country and the whole movement to bring women into politics. So mm-hmm. I'm hearing from all over the country people asking, what can we do? Reach out to Fair Fight and reach out to the two candidacies, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. And I'll just say this. I noticed that and you've probably seen this. We all have email boxes that are running over with messages. But a lot of organizations around the country, I mean, the last one I looked at was in Seattle, Washington, and they say, send us your money so that we can turn Georgia blue. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to work out there in Seattle, Washington. But
Right. Well, that's why I'm asking you, like, what are the best groups to be sending our money to or coming to live and support? Jack, actually, my husband asked me if I was going to move to Georgia for a couple of months. I don't know.
I know three people right now, just off the top of my head, that I personally know that are coming, that have contacted me. And there'll be people doing phone in. You can work with Fair Fight and with these campaigns, and with the Warnock and the Ossoff campaigns. You can work remotely. You can be at home mm. on your couch with your favorite pet and your favorite beverage and your phone and your computer, and you can be reaching Georgia voters, because we have to, that sleeping giant has awakened, and we have to, we just have to be putting out very clear, easy to understand information, because of course, people are going to be looking for ways to cast their ballot by mail here in Georgia. And they're going to need the information about early voting, which starts, oh my goodness, early voting starts, I don't want to misquote because all this has changed in the last 24 hours. But those are the information pieces that we'll be getting to folks with phone calls and texts and emails, as well as door to door. So you can work and make a difference for us in this race remotely. You don't have to move here and bring your favorite pillow and your iPhone. You can work for us right where you are. And I've done a lot of that because COVID is walking abroad in the land, and Georgia is one of the hotspot states. And so we have to be smart and wise and be standing up for safe practices. And I have reached voters hours at a time right in my home office, working with the state Democratic Party and with Fair Fight.
That's really great. And I did some of that in and the Biden campaign, I actually did go up with Jack to Pennsylvania because we realized how critical Pennsylvania would be to the victory. And we just did literature drops door to door. We didn't do voter contact for the reason you're stating. But, you know, sometimes there's nothing like boots on the ground, but so much of the campaigning has become remote. So our listeners who want to make a difference, if you want to really, whatever issue you care about is going to be better off if we can elect the two senators to Georgia that are in that January runoff.
Exactly. That's exactly the case. We absolutely need the funds to stay out there, stay on the ground, keep this infrastructure infused with the resources that we need. You know that the Republican money is going to pour into this state. Mm-hmm. So we've got to match it and vest them. And I want to think, Eleanor, that our voters are more incented. I think that there's going to be a drop off in Republican enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And they're getting such mixed messages, those who are loyal to that party, because the messages are Trump won, but your election officials in Georgia that you've elected are crooked, you know, so it's you can't trust the vote. So that's not a clear message for people, right?
I want to circle back. Yes, exactly. I want to circle back to that. You mentioned at the top of the hour here about Trump saying he's trying to discredit the election and wrongly calling voter fraud, of which there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. Right. But there are people concerned about a potential coup where Trump just discredits the election and then some of the Republican state legislators put forward their own slate of electors and actually push the election to Trump. But you don't think that's going to happen. So you know, just take 1 minute to explain to our listeners why we can actually sleep at night.
Well, I put nothing past the dedicated operatives, you know, to serve their master and come up with any wily scheme that they can concoct. But I don't think it will pass the smell test. The nation watched for a week as votes were counted. And you have the Arizona Secretary of State, who is a Republican, who's saying this state voted for Biden and that's not going to change. And this is a Republican, and he said it on Fox News. You have our Republican Secretary of State here saying our vote count shows clearly that Biden won this state, and that's not going to change. But I will do a recount. So I think it's such a preposterous reach. We should be ever vigilant, because some of these characters will do anything that they can. They'll do anything that they can get away with. We can't let them get away with that.
That's it.
We cannot let them get away with that. And I have a confidence in the sound judgment of a majority of Americans that won't pass the smell test.
That's great. I so appreciate that. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. The time flies always with you. Senator Nan Orrick, thank you so much for being with us today and for being such a wonderful progressive leader for Georgia and for the country.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. Keep up your good work. It's wonderful to connect today, and it'll be the not the last time, but one of many encounters I look forward to with you.
Likewise. Good luck.
Thank you.
Listeners, stay tuned for our next guest. Our next guest is Karina Arrive, Arizona State Advisor with the Movement Voter Project. Karina is a graduate from Arizona State University. She often shares her personal story of navigating the education system as an undocumented DACA student because her journey to finish college led her to the world of community activism and organizing. In 2016, she was part of the historic effort to get Sheriff Jeff Arpaio out of office, which succeeded. So thank you very much for that great work. And this year, Karina's been working in Arizona and is one of the reasons why we have shifted Arizona from red to blue. So welcome, Karina Arrive.
Hi, thank you for having me, Eleanor.
So I just first saw you yesterday listening to the great summary of the work from the Movement Voter Project that you and your colleagues have been doing. And I was just so grateful to all of you, you're like young, strong people out there really working, doing the organizing that it takes to win elections. So for our listeners who haven't heard of it, can you describe what is the Movement Voter Project?
Now, the Movement Voter Project is a national organization that helps build and support existing grassroots organizations on the ground across the country to build long-term power during the election, to win elections, and in the off seasons to continue to flex that muscle. So we are, in the 2020 cycle, we focused on the five presidential swing states, which Arizona, as we know, was one of them. And I am the Arizona state advisor and live in Arizona. I've been here for the last 20 years. And that was my primary focus with the Movement Voter Project, was to help support over 26 local organizations on the ground that were primarily people of color-led, immigrant-led, women-led, LGBTQ-led groups that do year-round organizing around issues that matter the most to their communities, but also do very important work to get out, to register and get out people to vote during election cycles.
Fantastic. Well, you've done just wonderful work, and I really appreciate it. And can you tell us a little bit what happened in Arizona? I mean, it's an important state for two reasons. One, it was a presidential swing state. It's turned out to be actually very pivotal in selecting the next president. And also, we had the key U.S. Senate race there with Mark Kelly, the Democrat, and the astronaut running for the U.S. Senate. So tell us what happened in Arizona on Tuesday night, election night.
Yeah, I mean, this was an election that a night like many other folks across the country we had been planning for and working for since 2016, right? Since the last announcement of the presidential race in 2016. And, you know, groups across the state had been gearing up in 2020. We were ready to hit the doors, hit the phones, talk to voters. And, you know, then there was COVID changed a lot of our initial planning. It changed a lot of the initial strategy, but we were able to overcome the obstacles faced with because of the pandemic. And we were still able to reach out to voters, talk to millions of over 2 million voters, register over 180,000 new voters. And what happened on Tuesday is that we finally were able to shift a very red state, which became purple in 2018 because of the same efforts from the same groups, to a blue state. And we flipped on the presidential. So our state went to Biden. And then we also won the very important Senate race. We now have two Democratic senators in our state. And we were also able to pick up, or are in the process of picking up, some very important state House and state Senate seats. So we are in the last cycle in 2018, which was a very important cycle for us, which solidified us as being more of a purple state. We picked up a lot of seats then in the midterm, but now we are only two seats away from flipping the state House. So it's likely that those races won't be called until the end of the week, but they are many of them are very close. And we are waiting for those efforts to pay off. And then we won at every level of up and down the ballot. We won county attorney races, one very important one here in Maricopa. We're waiting in Pima. So across the board, we saw great wins, especially when it came to education. We passed Prop 208, which is the ballot initiative that was put on the ballot by the people for increase in education funding.
Fantastic. And I know education is so important for so many people, and it's near and dear to your heart. And talk a little bit about like what education has meant for you personally in your own life.
Yeah, definitely. And before I say that, I think one thing that I'll add about what happened Tuesday mm-hmm. is that the efforts of all of the organizing that's been happening here for the last, not just 4 years, but 10 years, mm-hmm. Paid off. And we really saw the fruits of the labor of mm-hmm. grassroots organizing that was led by people of color, is what we truly saw on Tuesday night. Yes, education to me has been life-changing. I think it's really something that has made its mark and has been a big part of my story and my trajectory. I came into organizing because I was seeking more equitable education, access, and opportunities. Before DACA, I was paying out-of-state tuition in the state of Arizona because of a proposition called Prop 300, which bars undocumented students from receiving financial aid. And a lot of my advocacy started around education access and equity here in the state. So that is a fight that I fully support, both giving more access to as many people as possible in order for them to be able to be successful in education and contribute, but also to really reward our educators who are really also should be considered frontline workers, right? They're out there educating the next generation of leaders, the next generation of citizens. So we need to make sure that they are being compensated for their work.
Right. Very well said. Well, the education can be a doorway to a better life for so many people. And it worked for me. It's working for you, and want to open that door to as many people as possible. So good for you for doing that. So back to turning Arizona from red to purple to blue. You had some great successes.
Can you please get him? I'm sorry.
That's okay. You've got a child. I've got a cat.
Yeah.
So, so some of the great successes that bore fruit on Tuesday night, as you said, were kind of a long time in the making. So who were some of the people that were behind that organizing that really made that shift possible?
Yeah. So yesterday I explained that every time I talk about how we came to this moment, even a few months ago or weeks ago before the election, as I would talk about my projections, was that we needed to understand the history of the state and the movement to understand the moment that we're currently in. And I think, you know, for decades, obviously, we've had amazing organizers, but a turning point specifically and how we got from red to blue was back in 2010. There was an anti-immigrant bill that was passed here in the state, SB 1070, which is the Show Me Your Papers law, mm-hmm. for those of you who don't know, which basically turned police into immigration authorities and allowed them the jurisdiction to ask people for their immigration status and documentation, and to pull people over for anything that they believe to be probable cause that they may be here, quote unquote, illegally. And we know that that was an awful policy, an awful law, and it really sparked, you know, a lot of fear in the immigrant community. We're a border mm-hmm. state here. We have a lot of immigrant folks, but we also have, you know, a lot of second, third generation immigrant folks, Latinx community, people of color that were going to be targeted by this law, which was a very blatant racist law, and a racial profile would lead to racial profiling. And this law was really passed in an effort by the state legislature to force an exodus of immigrants out of the country. Mm-hmm. And it aside from doing all of these, sparking this fear and this outrage and all of this, you know, at that moment, there was something else that happened too, which was Our local leaders at that time, who were very young, some who are still in the movement now, 10 years ago, had a choice to make, and that choice was to either succumb to that fear and to the attacks that the legislature was putting upon us, or to like stand up and fight. And that's what that was the path that was chosen, to stand up and fight against this horrible policy. And many leaders came together and in unison to do something about this. And within a year, the author of that bill was recalled out of his position in office by these young leaders. They formed a coalition, put a campaign together, and recalled him. And the trajectory just kept going, cycle after cycle. These leaders kept growing and learning and working together, not only educating and advocating for against awful bills and for bills that were for the community, but also registering and turning out people to vote cycle after cycle. We got rid of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We got rid of Pierce, who wrote SB 1070. We also passed amazing policy that would benefit the citizens of the state, like Prop 206, which increased the minimum wage. So there was all of these things, and all the common denominator of all of these campaigns is that they have been led by local grassroots organizations like Mi Familia Vota, Lucha Arizona, Poder in Action, just to name a few. And these are all organizations that come from the community. They're led by young people of color, by women, by immigrant folks, by indigenous people. And the reason that these folks have been successful is because they are best equipped to talk to the voters that they are trying to turn out, which are also, you know, young people of color, immigrant folks, indigenous people, because that base is really representative of the majority here in the state. And we want our elected officials and the policy that we are pushing for to be representative of our values and what's important to us. So in 2018, we picked up a lot of seats, had a lot of victories, like I mentioned, went from red to purple. And this year we were ready to bring it home and to do the full blue flip, and we did it.
Fantastic. So this has been like a 10-year odyssey of organizing, and from that 2020 horrendous, you know, I felt a little bit when that was passed, I was like, oh my God, this is America. That sounds more like what South Africa did with the blacks, so like show me your papers. But I'm so glad that got overturned and was kind of a spark to make a lot of changes, get Sheriff Joe out of there and many other changes. You personally, like, how many years have you been organizing now in Arizona? Did you get in around the Sheriff Arpaio?
So I started in 2010, and that was the SB 1070 fight. I started volunteering, coming out to marches, and then was engaged by some of these groups and started developing my different skills. The first campaign I did was actually a voter registration campaign. In the 2014 midterm, and that was a nonpartisan campaign where I talked to voters about the importance of voting for candidates that supported Dreamers. And that was really my first experience of talking to voters one-on-one. It was a very small campaign, but I learned a lot. And then in 2018, in 2016, I worked on the Basta Arpaio campaign, which was, you know, a community effort by Poder in Action, Lucha Arizona, and a few other folks that came together to get rid of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And it was an amazing feeling when that happened in 2016. And we were successful in doing that.
Fantastic. And so talk a little bit about your role this year in the election. You're the state advisor in Arizona for the Movement Voter Project. What does that mean to be state advisor? Were you helping to coordinate all the local grassroots groups, or what was your role?
Mm-hmm. So like I mentioned, the Movement Voter Project is a national organization, and specifically our role this year was to help, like you mentioned, coordinate some of the efforts if there was need to do that. I've been lucky to work in a state where there's a lot of coordination and groups. You know, that's why we've been successful. Groups have been able to come together and build statewide plans that allow us to maximize our efforts when we're reaching out to talk to voters. But my job was also to make sure that groups had all of the resources that they needed so that they had adequate trainings for get out the vote efforts, that they had adequate access and trainings on tools, especially in a year where I mentioned that field efforts to reach out to voters would look different because of some of the usual tactics were delayed because of the pandemic. So we relied a lot on technology, and part of my job was making sure that the organizations all had access to these tools and were trained on these tools, and that they also had adequate funding to pay staff, to have access to these tools, to run their field programs. So part of the work that MVP does is fundraise so that we can move, a big part of what we do is move resources to these groups so that they can worry about what's important, which is talking to voters, talking about the issues, and making sure that we can protect our democracy.
Right. And you've been successful not only in the organizing, but on the fundraising also. Tell our listeners, like, how much money did Movement Voter Project raise this year for this 2020 election?
It was over $100 million that was moved directly to groups in the cycle, which is amazing. And, you know, everything that we raise goes directly to our partners. And it makes the world of a difference, especially, you know, since 2016, we saw a lot of new organizing that started to be galvanized because of Trump's election. And within, you know, even more so now as we got closer to the election. In the last 2 years, there has been a lot of added groups to the infrastructure. So for example, here in Arizona, this year there were, or in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of new Black-led organizing, indigenous-led organizing that we wanted to support. So being able to give them their first grant and continued support just means the world to these organizations and is able to really move their work forward in a way that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do.
That's impressive. $100 million it's a lot of money to be moving. It's a major factor. And over how many states was that $100 million spent?
We fund, I think, over 20 states. Again, a majority of the funding went to our what we call tier one and tier two states, or tier ones this year were our presidential and Senate states, including Pennsylvania, Arizona, Florida, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And then we had some tier two states, including Georgia. And a lot of the funding really went there, which you can see is paying off. We were able to flip Arizona. We are on the I think we've already had Wisconsin called in Michigan. I'm not sure. Yes. And then we're waiting on Georgia. So, you know, we really moved resources in the states that we knew were going to be pivotal this year. And we wanted to make sure we did everything that we could to ensure that groups had resources to talk to as many voters as possible.
That's fantastic. So what's your favorite story? You're obviously working with a lot of local organizing groups within Arizona, mostly young people, mostly people of color. What's your favorite experience that kind of gives a good illustration of what it was like working in Arizona this year for the election?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many. To me, my favorite part, I think my favorite all over the end of this year, you know, a lot of the election was done remotely, which I think was like, was different and maybe a little disappointing for people because we were ready and then the pandemic came and it was like, oh, it was a little deflating at the beginning of the year, trying to figure out our footing. But just to see how resilient folks were and how innovative folks were. Actually, in March, I went out, a few months ago, I went out with the crew that came down to film our Arizona video for MVP, which you can find on our website. And I got to travel all across the state. I went to Navajo Nation. Wow. And yeah, I was there. I traveled up to Navajo Nation for a few days with a video crew. And there's an organization called Diné Care. They are the Diné people, native to Arizona, Navajo. And I got to be with them for, I think, 3 days. And I had already learned a lot about their organizing. We support them. But to be there in person in their community, mm-hmm. they took us up to a generating station, which they'd been fighting against for years, that they were successful in closing down through their advocacy. And it was just amazing to be in a part of Arizona. And I'd lived here for so long and I'd never been there before. Mm-hmm. So to be there and then to hear about, you know, Navajo Nation was impacted greatly by the pandemic, disproportionately right. to other parts of the country. And to see that they were still still ready to fight and to continue to fight during this election, despite of everything that was happening, was really, I'm getting the chills right now, was really moving and really reminded me of why I do this work.
That's fantastic. And what do you think, you know, you've been so successful in Arizona over these 10 years. What do you think are the lessons we can learn from Arizona that might help us in other states?
I think that the number one thing is investment in POC-led groups, and POC means people of color. Investment in these grassroots groups, LGBTQ, women-led, immigrant-led groups, so that those groups can continue to grow their leadership, can continue to grow their organizations, and can continue to grow their base so that they can empower others, they can empower their neighbors, people in their community to get involved and to come out and vote. This is how we are going to be able to replicate what's happened in Arizona across the country. Supporting these groups financially, number one, investment, but also supporting them with your volunteer hours and time if you have it. Overall investment of the entire ecosystem of an organization is what's needed. And then also investing in the overall ecosystem of the state. So working together, like what we've seen here in Arizona, it's not only one organization doing the work, it's multiple doing their part and then working together to see the results that we've been able to see.
Right. And what can our listeners do? I mean, we can't all live in Arizona or even in a swing state, but what can our listeners do to help make change in our home states, wherever we may live?
Yeah, regardless if you live in a swing state or not, there's always different opportunities for you to create change at a local level. So I think some of the biggest fights and best victories are made at the local level, school boards, city council races, state legislatures, all of those things. Or even if we're not talking about elected positions, if we're talking about advocating for issues, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something you can do. So I would encourage you to join an organization, find a community of like-minded people and be an ally. And go out there and find how you can get involved. You know, if you're busy or if you have a lot going on, another way that you can support is to give some of your money to one of these organizations and help seed the investment. That's just as important. We understand that everybody has a role to play, and that's also something that's greatly appreciated, is being able to give that that monetary support so that these organizations can run cycle in and cycle out.
Right. Well, I encourage our listeners to check out your group, the Movement Voter Project. And I'm impressed with the way you work and the way you treat each other so respectfully and sensitively. And I think, you know, it gives me great hope for the country to know that you and your colleagues. Thank you so much for all
thank
the great
so
work
that you do.
Thank
you so much for having me today. It was a pleasure.
Karina Uribe with the Movement Voter Project. That's all the time we have. Thanks so much and hope to have you back sometime.
Look forward to it.